Alive and Kicking with Claire McKenna on News Talk.
Now, if you're a parent waiting on an assessment, you'll know this much. Childhood doesn't wait, and families can't press pause while the system catches up. A new book is asking us to rethink how we support our youngest children and their families. Joining me now is clinical psychologist Martin O'Connor, author of Early Childhood Intervention, Time for a New Conversation. Martin, you're very welcome.
Thank you, Claire.
And tell us a little bit about your work and your experience of those wait times that I mentioned.
Well, I've worked many years in what's referred to as disability services, both for supporting adults and children and families. I had first-hand experience, I suppose, of the issue of waiting times and waiting for diagnosis when I worked as a clinical manager of children's services in Clare in the Midwest for a period of time. It's usually a period of great stress and frustration for parents in particular. And at times it can seem like, you know, a family's life is put on hold as they wait for this diagnosis to happen. At the same time, I was very struck by an article that I read in the Irish Times back in October 2024, I think it was, which described the situation that you and I are talking about in beautiful detail. It's a beautifully written article by the aunt of a little boy with a developmental disability. And it refers to his mum and dad waiting with frustration for a diagnostic assessment to happen. But the piece that caught my eye at the time was the way in which the little boy is described. And he's described as being able to find his way across the kitchen floor to get from A to B. And getting to B means getting to a favourite toy. And his aunt describes him as doing it not in the normal way, but doing it in his own way. And I just had a light bulb moment of thinking, well, this is child development in action on the kitchen floor. And where is the support for his mum and dad to, if you like, join the dance that he's inviting them into? And I refer on a few occasions in the book that parenting in many ways is a dance led by children. And I suppose if there is a significant difference between typically developing children and children with developmental disability, and additional support needs, is that they do often need additional help themselves to discern and decipher the dance that their child is leading them into. So how the child tries to give communication signals and helping parents to be more aware of when that happens, because these are moments for connection, particularly for children who are autistic.
And I do think you handle that really well throughout the book, because it's a difficult, to borrow your word, dance or line to tread, to meet parents or caregivers of a child with a developmental issue, some compassion for what is happening and accept that, yes, they do deserve support, but to also empower them to lean on their own intuitions and their own parenting. Because as you said in the beginning, often family life can go on hold, and through no fault of their own and with the best of intention, there are parents and caregivers who are sort of waiting to be told what to do. And you really wanted to, as you said there, empower them to know that often the relationship that you have with your child, no one is going to know them better than you.
Absolutely. And I have done some training down through the years with what used to be called early intervention teams, and I've always made the point to people working in the area of what's called early intervention to be very careful and sensitive, particularly in the first meeting you have with a mum and or a dad, because in reality you're meeting the world expert on the child. Now, the parent mightn't have a sense of that, because of the issues that have arisen for them entering into this new unknown world. And by that I mean the unknown emotional world that they now find themselves in, and then this new unknown, previously unknown professional world that they now find themselves coming into. And the phrase family-centered, in a way, has become a bit of a buzzword, and its application is sadly often lacking. It's fine to declare it as policy, but the actual practice of it with families can be a different kettle of fish, so to speak, in terms of the impact of it. And what I mean by that is that the fact of there being a child in a family who has additional needs means that the life and learning and development of that child is already family-centred. So services often seem to believe that family-centeredness starts when the family meets with the service. But family-centeredness is already in train from the moment of the birth of the child. So the parent already knows intimate details about this child that a professional can never know. And a parent has a way of knowing and often has developed skills through necessity in terms of what helps the child, what helps the child to feel relaxed, what helps the child to regulate, what helps the child to have fun, what helps the child to participate as best they can in the activities and routines of daily life. And that's child development in action. And that's why I referred in the book in some detail to the framework of what's called the F words for child development. Because in essence, the F words cover what is child development. And for me, that should be the focus of early intervention for children in families. And the F words are basically functioning, how the child engages with and participates in the life of the world around him or her. Family being the main environment, particularly for young children. Family is the main environment. Later on, it might be a creche, might be preschool, maybe junior infants and the early classes in school. But these are the key environments in which children's learning and development happens. And that's the importance of functioning. Fitness, which is often a topic that maybe isn't spoken about as much as it should be in relation to children with additional needs. Not just their physical fitness, but mental health and emotional well-being, a sense that they belong, that they're welcomed, that they're seen, that they're respected, that they're needed and that they're wanted and that they're loved. That's all to do with mental well-being and quality of life. The importance of friends, which can often be a huge challenge for families where you have a child with additional needs. Very often the child will have friends maybe in the early years in school, and then there can be sort of a parting of the ways as the child and other peers get older and develop different interests and so on. So that can be a challenge, but it's very, very important for quality of life and well-being for any child. So I've mentioned functioning, family, fitness, fun, the importance of fun. What is it in the child's life that the child likes to do that makes him or her smile, that makes them laugh? Who do they like to spend time with that brings fun into their lives? And also, last but not least, the importance of future, because child development is always a work in progress. As I said earlier, it might be more difficult to spot it in children with additional needs, developmental disability. But at the same time, to me, that is one of the primary roles of competent professionals, that they're able to help parents to spot the signals that the child is giving, because these are the moments when the child is open for connection. And in that context, in the book, I mentioned the Martha Mayo interaction approach, which I had personal experience of in the past working professionally. And I find it to be a really powerful way, particularly for autistic children in families and in preschool environments, to help parents and the adults around the autistic child to, if you like, begin to move into the world of the child and connect with the world of the child in order to help the child to get a sense of what's going on in the emotional world of other people, which can be a difficult social and emotional challenge for autistic people, autistic children.
You also talk in the book about the culture of parental guilt, and alongside professional perfectionism, it creates a perfect storm. I'd also add the stress, perhaps, of trying to live through all of that into that. So how do people navigate that? What impact is that having?
Research that I carried out back in 2015 with six mothers. I was doing a master's in coaching psychology in UCC at the time, and this was my dissertation topic. And these six mothers kindly agreed to be interviewed by me. And the question I was interested in was, how did they navigate the years that they spent while their child was travelling through, so to speak, children's services? So at the time that I met these mothers and interviewed them, practically all of their children and young people were older than 18 years of age, so they had moved beyond the remit, if you like, of children's disability services. And that research really gives, I think, a very accurate insight to the question that you're asking in terms of how parents have to try and navigate what I mentioned earlier as being a previously unknown emotional world, a previously unknown professional world that they're moving into. And I think very often, and I say this with kindness because I'm a professional healthcare worker myself, or at least I was, I think the degree of sensitivity and ability to build rapport and to take your time, particularly in that first contact meeting with a family, with a parent, is absolutely critical. Because parents remember these meetings for many, many a day, indeed for the rest of their lives, just as they do remember how a diagnosis was given to them. Even when they know what the diagnosis is likely to be, there is still something hugely important about how a professional healthcare worker or any medical professional will communicate that information to a family. And the follow-up that's often lacking, it might simply be a phone call a week later after the family received the diagnosis, simply to ask them, well, how are you since we last spoke? Many families have said to me that they would welcome such a phone call, but sadly, very often, it doesn't happen. And that's a moment missed in terms of building relationship between healthcare professionals and families. And in the research that I carried out, the parents talked about their initial feelings of vulnerability. The vulnerability of being told there's something, in inverted commas, wrong with your child. The vulnerability that that brings in play in terms of all the plans and aspirations and hopes and dreams that you had in terms of being a parent and how this changes all of that. And then the additional vulnerability that happens when parents meet with healthcare professionals for the first time, perhaps being asked the same questions as they've previously been asked. And I always make the point to healthcare professionals, in that first meeting that you have with parents, take time to ask them about all the other professionals they've met up to that point, because their journey has already begun before you meet with them. They probably already have met with a paediatrician or a consultant, a public health nurse, a GP, and so forth. And be interested and curious about what have those professionals said to this parent about their child. What kind of mental picture had they given them about their child in the future? Are people playing God and making predictions that really are not warranted? Because these are the thoughts and the feelings that the parents bring into that first meeting with the healthcare professional in a children's service. And that needs to be conversed about. That needs to be talked about. Because that's where the parent is at. That's where they're starting at. And the parent might not agree with the way in which their child has been described, because it doesn't tally with the reality of what they see the child trying to do at home, trying to get involved with at home, who the child turns to look at when somebody walks in the door, moves from one room to the next, paying attention, the family pet, how the child gets on. This is the stuff of real life, and I think sometimes unintentionally, and there are many, many good people, really good people working in children's disability network teams, but very often they're hamstrung by the system that they're working in. Which, and an example I've often used, Claire, is where on the one hand, the powers that be proclaim that family-centred practice is the policy that drives practice, but yet that same system is asking people on a monthly basis, how many children did you see last month? They're two conflicting and very different agendas, and they're very, very difficult, if not impossible, to blend into what's called genuine family-centred practice. And at the end of the day, coming back to your really good question, at the end of the day, the simplest way of, I suppose, talking about something which is very complex and very difficult often to get your head around is the fact that for children from 0 to 6, at least, if not 0 to 8, their primary learning environment, whether this is accepted or not, their primary learning environment is their family environment. And that means that the primary focus of children's disability network teams actually has to be parenting and supporting parents and families to provide the kind of environment so the child can be the best he or she can be engaged in real life routines and activities in the family, and function as well as the child can in terms of participating in family routines, rituals, activities, relationships, and so forth.
Martin, thank you very much for joining us.
Alive and Kicking with Claire McKenna. Sunday morning at 8 on News Talk. Conversation that counts.